My wife keeps telling me that retiring means you take things a bit easier, but I'm a very slow learner on that. And it's given me a lot more time to actually write and put things on paper. And one of the ventures I've been involved in, working with an Australian colleague called John Smythe, who's been working on this area for 15 years or more. We've just sent a book to the publishers, and there's a chapter in here, a composite social justice book that I wrote one chapter of it on child poverty and schooling, which is almost a sketch of the bigger book. Put some copies on sale at lunchtime after the advert. I think the crucial thing is that we've got an issue here which is widely recognised to be the big question for Scotland. The biggest issue in terms of overall achievement as well as social cohesion. Children's lives are being blighted. Britain overall is one of the most divided societies in Europe. The OECD were invited to Scotland 5-6 years ago to do a report. This was seen as the number one issue. And yet on the national agenda, I seriously think it's marginalised. I mean, I don't see the dynamics that I heard at the beginning of the morning. One of the things I'm working towards in my spare hours is trying to set up some sort of forum across Scotland, working with people in various universities, teachers in schools, so we can actually share ideas, build up thinking on this, and lean on the policymakers a bit, you know, work with them as well. Because I think this is... we're not actually even collecting the data properly in Scotland. If we can just say that in England they're obsessed with numbers. The trouble is they use them to bash teachers with. But we don't have parallel data here. I mean, in England, the data shows very clearly, and it's been the same for the last 10 years, it doesn't change things, that if you're on free meals, on average, you have half the chance of coming out with the equivalent of 5 credits as the rest of the population. On average. Now, that's dangerous because you can use it to be fatalistic and to say, well, what more can you do? These are just kids growing up on this estate. What more can we expect? So I don't want to go down that sort of fatalistic route. But it shows a serious level whereby the social hierarchy gets recycled if we're not careful. And so this book, been trying to go back through the last 60 years, maybe a bit more, about how is this explained? Because everybody recognises that poverty links to low achievement as a tendency. But there is such massive disagreement about why. Now, going back through the history of all of this, time and time again, it's gone in phases, but every phase seems to add up to a sort of blame the victim. I mean, Tim Brighouse sort of said something about it, you know, failure to learn. You know, it's very easy to say, well, my kid's unteachable. And sometimes it feels like that, and I've been in that situation in my own teaching career. But as he said this morning, first of all, it was intelligence. Intelligence is general, is inherited, so what more can you do except for a few exceptions? The Scottish lad of Perth. Yeah? Then around the 1960s, as that was blown completely wide open, even the research that was based on turned out to be fraudulent. I don't know if that's widely known. Cyril Burt, the chief educational psychologist in London, had published papers which supposedly measured the IQ of twins who'd subsequently been adopted. And it was fraudulent from beginning to end, and he built an entire career about it. And the testing of children at age 10 and 11 across the UK was built on that evidence, and they never happened. This was established after his death. We then got, in the 1960s, both sides of the Atlantic, different versions of this, but the notion that it's all due to parents. Working class parents was a term used, basically meant Basil Bernstein's the key name here. The blame focuses on parents, manual worker parents. A, don't talk to the children, they just smack them. It's quite ironic because in those days the one place where a kid could guarantee getting a hiding was at school. But it was a manual worker parents, they smack their children, the other parents don't, they explain to them. They only talk about things that are happening in their immediate surroundings. They don't have any knowledge about the rest of the world, don't talk about it. And they use pronouns instead of nouns. And now, this versions of this have continued ever since. And there are, when I pin it down, and I've gone through the research, you get a situation where some low-income parents who have not had a good education themselves, some end up with three-year-olds and five-year-olds with a very weak vocabulary. But this then becomes a myth that it's all down to the parents, and that working class parents in general, manual worker parents in general, you know, are very limited in their speech. And that's why children are ineducable. What actually happens, in fact, is that throughout the years of schooling, the social gap, the achievement gap gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And one of the starkest lessons to me was to see a graph which showed that of the poorest section of the population, the highest achieving of those kids at age 11. So those kids who are achieving against the odds at age 11, only one in seven of them gets to university. Well, that's quite a stark drop-off. Yeah? So something happens in school. And then you get the next blame, which is aspirations. Families are not ambitious for the children. And this is a way of psychologising the issue and saying that you can have aspirations without opportunities. You know, aspirations are just a psychological mood thing. And I know that, you know, children differ and families differ, and my own parents were very, very ambitious for me because of the way that they'd been put back. You know, my mother constantly tells me that she sat the test for grammar school but was told not to bother because her family would not be able to afford the expensive uniform. So, you know, that frustration then came back on myself and my brother, and they were determined for us. So, but this general thing. And the next blame is teachers, not in Scotland so much, though some people have told me this weekend that some HMI are still are treating teachers in this way. But almost getting, damning, you almost get blamed, you know, regarded as being sort of inadequate as a teacher because you're teaching in a school with high levels of poverty and low results. Yeah? And so you get these different things. And the more I looked at it and talked to the colleague in Australia and looked at the different studies, the first thing that struck me is that there are very few studies, very few academic, sociological studies of working class life in those areas blighted by deindustrialisation since the 1980s. Sometimes areas where unemployment has gone on for two into the third generation. Very few studies, but the message that does come back from them is an overwhelming sense of A, low self-esteem, shame, sometimes expressed as furious anger and very directionless, but a sense of shame almost. And the other, a sense of futility, that whatever you try doesn't work out. I mean, one lovely interview that I saw in one book, somebody in Doncaster, the mother says, well, my son's done a training course and he trained to fill shelves at the supermarket, and then he was an unemployed shelf filler, and he did another training course, and now he's on a forklift training course, so he'll end up being an unemployed forklift driver. You know, and that sense of frustration and things don't work out is not a climate in which to build ambition. There are, and without getting into the blame thing, which I think we must absolutely avoid, it is apparent that there are some schools which somehow manage to counter this, to work against this, and create a sense of value, and create a sense of, you know, that it's not futile, it is worth something. And that is really something that we've got to find out more about. We've got to find out and share. Another issue that I'm particularly interested in is how do teachers who have no personal experience of life on the estate, yeah, how do they understand it? And one of the difficulties is, I think, and it's just a working hypothesis, you have an encounter with an angry mother who's come into the school to challenge something, and there is a danger that you then, and it's a common human tendency obviously, you then start generalising from there and thinking that everybody who lives down that street is like that, and like that all the time. So there's a stereotyping that can go on. How many people here have read Owen Jones' book, Chavs? It's a bestseller. It's well worth reading. Chavs is a superb piece of sociology and politics, because he's talking about how stereotypes of white, poorer white people have been generated through the media and by the politicians. And I think it's, the real question is, have these stereotypes, I'll put this on as an open question right now, what is the impact of the national UK government's discourse about benefit scroungers, about drawing benefits being a lifestyle choice, in George Osborne's words, about strivers versus skivers and all the rest. What do we know? What is the impact of this on the consciousness of children? Resounding silence in the room. I mean, I suspect it's got an impact, but we can't put our fingers on it. And really, a second question is, how do we find out that? There have been some studies of child poverty in terms of what difference it makes to lives. And one of the things that, I mean, I refer to it in this book, one of the things that comes up here is, if I can find the right chapter, it affects friendships, because children can't afford to do the things that other friends at school are doing. In rural areas, the affordability of travel, not having the clothes that other kids will respect, you know, feeling that you don't go out. Maybe this particularly affects girls more than boys, but probably both. You don't go out because you don't have the right clothes to wear, and people might look down on you. Lovely quote. If you don't wear trendy stuff, not so many people will be your friend because of what you wear. It was real hard because all our mates would be doing everything, and we'd think, oh, I want to do that. We'd try and ask mum, and then we'd think, what if she asks? Well, look, I've only got a bit of money. Then we'd feel guilty for asking, so we didn't ask it. Yeah? So it's internalised then. Do we even map which kids don't take part in the school trips and why. All sorts of issues. So, I mean, one of the questions is how not just policy at a big level, but policy at an individual school level. How do we develop the knowledge? One of the things, when does this session finish? Is it 20 past, half past?
20
past. 20 past, okay, I want to get this time right. I've got a visiting professorship, which sounds very grand, down in Leeds, and we're working on a project with kids in some schools there, and with the teachers, practitioner research project, basically. And we just tried a very basic interview as a pilot, and you know, there's an invitation, you know, try this, develop some data on this. I did the same with a youth worker at Rathlock and get very, very similar results. We're asking very basic questions because one of the things that was of concern is really how much do teachers know about children's lives? Both about the serious hardships and limitations, but secondly, about sources of support. Sources of support from family, from neighbourhood, sources of stimulation. And we asked some very basic questions like, who do you know that's travelled a bit? Who do you know that's reads books or watches, you know, nature programmes on telly? Or who do you know who's the most interesting person you know? Who helps you with your homework? Who's got an interesting job? We found all sorts of lovely, wonderful, positive little things. So I want to share a little bit of this with you. And I think it's going to have to be sometimes one between two. And I've condensed a little bit just out of an interview, a teacher and me sitting next to them, and three pupils. It's marked as girls sometimes, because the two girls were twins, and often we couldn't tell which one was speaking. So if I sort of pass those round, and you'll see on here, it begins on the side, so what are the good things about living in this area? And I'd just like you to spend 5 minutes reading this. And what do you pick up out of this? What's interesting out of this? And I haven't picked on this deliberately. This was just the first one we did. It was a pilot.
So here's some of the things that the children said and some of the questions. So what are the good things about living in this area? Girls. Close to school, close to your friends, close to town, opposite the hospital. If you get hurt, that's where you go. Boy. The people. My dad's job, he works at the hospital. And then the questioner says, okay, what did you say? The people? And the boy says, I'm guessing it's just the chavs. It's just the thing that reminds me of England, just the chavs. And the teacher asks, what's a chav? Yes, what's a chav? I don't know, said the girl. Boy, well, I wouldn't say that they always walk around in hoodies, but they might wear them. Yes, more than other people. But I'm trying not to be a hypocrite. And further on, the next question is, who's the next most interesting person you know? And the girl says, my nan. The girl says, well, she's not like any other nan. She's just like, she knows what we like, and she's not like one of them that walks around going, I need a cup of tea. She doesn't say that. She does say that, but she's not the type to be sat down. She's the type to be out playing outside with me and my cousins. The teacher, so a young nan, a young granny. A young nan who wears 5-inch heels uptown. She's supportive as well. She teaches you like to go for your dreams, but be careful as well. And the boy's telling about somebody who he finds most interesting. Dylan Walker, he's one of my friends in year 10. He does parkour, I presume in parkour, like free running. But he also likes to play his games and stuff like I do. I do it a lot. He's like open to everything. Like an open mind. Yes, he likes everything. If he doesn't like stuff, he'll tell people that he doesn't like it. Internet speak, like loads of people got together on the internet and started making websites and it got real popular. They've got their own way of saying things and what stuff means, like their own language. He knows that. He does everything, really. He's really interesting. And the next question is, somebody you know who's got the most interesting job you've heard of? And the girl says, our teacher. Our uncle, he's a head teacher. The other girl says, assistant head teacher, and he teaches drama. And he's got loads of awards for performing as well. And later on, the other girl says, or our other uncle who works in a power station. And the girl then says, another person I look up to was my granddad because he was like in war camp when he was 14. He was raised with manners. He was rich, but he wasn't spoilt about it. They had disused house that the Germans, the other girl corrects her, Japanese, tore up and everything. He watched people die in front of him, but he managed to treat me and my Sophie like his daughters. He's got his old children, but because they live in Canada, they don't really speak. So that's just some of the comments that we were reading during the quiet time in the podcast, which I've just recorded over.
Any reflections on this? Anything jumps out at you? Did
I love the bit about the chaps, because I have a 16-year-old and an 11-year-old, and particularly when she was 14, my 16-year-old used to talk about chaps. And of course I'd ask her, what's a chap, who's a chap, who's not, you know, where do you make the distinction? And of course she found it very, very difficult. And then in the end it came down to clothes and how they were worn and you know, certain phrases and speech and things like that. But it was, to begin with, it was so cut and dry, but when she started having to kind of articulate what that was about, she herself realised how prejudiced it was.
Yeah. I mean, Keith Scottish was scheming, isn't it?
Well, chaff for our kids seems to be the phrase.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yes.
I like the second one, that is my nan. Mm.
Yes.
And because she gives her maximum freedom, and she comes to the level of her, and she plays with her. So I like that one because freedom is always necessary for the children, and independence is necessary, and one should come to the level of the children so that one can teach the children.
Come on.
Yes. Okay. Just going back to the number, I thought it was interesting how the parents sort of said, you can't do that, we can't do that, whereas the man is the one who's putting a positive attitude on it, saying, well, you can never do that. Yeah, but that was
I was just going to say the boy seems to, yes, all other people that he knows does things, and he's got very limited experience himself. He just knows, now gone beyond the town, and that comes through quite strongly.
Yes. Yeah, on the second page, somebody didn't have this. He said, that, have you ever travelled? And he said, well, I once went beyond Asda. Mm-hmm. And it was the same as this side of Asda. And yet he talks about some of the musical culture in his family. And his dad's a very good electric guitarist. Mm-hmm. Very good rock guitarist. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So he is, sorry, one I don't thing, want the same person.
One thing
time.
I want to add.
Okay, go on.
Yes, here the teacher is not giving any direction. Again, the teacher is exploring the situation, or his real life situation is taking, and he is again giving some situation to explore something. That is important.
Thank you. Who else?
Just thought it was interesting that the wee boy talking about who he admired, and I can't know if it's a cousin or a brother. Mm-hmm. It was a free runner, and that's not a self. It's not a socially accepted status. It's a, you know, he's got that, he's good at something, but it's not something that was just.
And, but the very interesting thing is, he says this is somebody who would talk to a lot and who's got lots of ideas, who's got lots of IT skills. Mm-hmm. And he talks about his brother on the second page, who's got a really interesting job, and it's not what a lot of us might call a really interesting job, but he works at Ryman's. Mm-hmm. But it's a good job. It's a good job in that neighbourhood. And his brother has helped him a lot and supported him a lot. And one of the things these interviews brought home to me and to the teacher who was leading the interview was, this is not the stereotype. this is not the Daily Mail or the Daily Express's stereotype of life on these estates. It's not the stereotype of the feckless underclass. This is like a much richer image, both in terms of its limitations, and once went beyond Asda, but also about potentially rich circles of support. The other interesting thing, and this is a bit of an irony though, reading this over for the third time, it struck me that Andy, who's the deputy head of the school, actually his comments, very warm, very responsive, but they never actually thought of this in terms of curriculum. So we had these girls telling us about the uncle who'd grown up in the Philippines, been captured by the Japanese in the, you know, in the fascist takeover in the 1940, and so on and so forth. It wasn't seen as curriculum. And the other thing that we talked about afterwards and with other teachers in the school is there's no obvious mechanism for developing that knowledge about where the potential sources of support are and the riches of knowledge, and bringing it somehow into the school so that it's not this school, this is learning, this is school, that is the world out there. And that's a really, really difficult challenge. Anybody else?
I think I was just struck with the, I remember being beyond Alistair, I've been doing a little bit of studies now on how contracted people, children's lives have become. Yeah. And some of the writers on that are looking at the possibility of children become less likely to take risks,
yeah,
because they're less in controlled environments, you know, really, whereas perhaps in our youth we're a bit more free roaming. Mm.
Yeah. But I mean, I think also the significant thing is here, Leeds is absolutely surrounded by the most beautiful countryside in Britain. Some of it, apart from the Trossachs. I mean, it's on a par with the Trossachs, isn't it? It's surrounded by the most wonderful, dramatic countryside. It is rich in history. You know, the Romans, the medieval monasteries, the whole lot of it within 10 miles. And these are kids who, without enough money in the education system, are going to have to somehow make sense of what the teacher's talking about without having seen any of it. And I think it raises questions about, you know, assumptions that we sometimes make about more able children, less able children. Do we actually mean sometimes that in part more experienced children, less experienced children? Children who come to school have already at the age of 5 been to some of those places. basically, you know, what my own way of thinking at the moment is that we've somehow got to develop the knowledge. We've got this legacy of false theories, fixed intelligence, bad parenting, low aspirations, bad teachers, and all the rest of it. But we don't have a rich source within the Scottish environment of positive knowledge to help people do something about this situation and challenge the people with their hands on the purse strings, limited as that is at the moment. I mean, I would, anybody who's interested, certainly I'll be making an approach to the EIS. We're trying to get this off the ground, trying to develop that sort of forum, and we want teachers involved in that right from the very beginning. So if anybody is keen to get involved right from the early stage on this, as I said, there's a lot of experience in this room. Yeah.
I think I'm correct in saying that England is just about to ditch its gifted and talented programme.
Yes.
And I would think, at least thank goodness we didn't have that in Scotland, because that system of creaming off 5 and 10% and saying, right, the top 5-10% are the ones we're going to call gifted, and concentrate all the, you know, the best resources, the higher order thinking skills,
yes,
on them. Scotland isn't going in that direction, at least.
How do you how do you work out that somebody who's gifted for academic and talented for more creative arts sort of thing, how do you know that somebody is not talented musically or in drama if they've never had the opportunity? I mean, it's intensely discriminatory. On the other hand, a lot of those programmes and a lot of the summer schools were tremendously exciting educationally. Why isn't that the entitlement here in Scotland for all the kids who want to? You know, what is the framework for leading that and for working? I mean, it's an Tim Brighouse in Birmingham, one of the great things that happened there while he was Director of Education. They had two organisations been set up largely by teachers with authority support. One they called the University of the First Age. That was the secondary school one. And the other they called the Primary... I forgot what the other title was. But they did all sorts of things. They ran weekend schools, they ran summer schools, and they also ran theme days in school and worked with the teachers, and they acted like a catalyst to, you know, develop the enthusiasm and to develop the new ideas. And that is something that all children have a right to, not just the 10% who are picked off.
But, I mean,
so I'm glad we don't have that.
Yes, I think that is as in...
well, I wish we had something better.
I remember, if I could...
Go ahead. Okay,
sir. Now, I just wanted to... obviously, maybe I'm different working in Glasgow, but I would just like to challenge some of the assumptions here, how successful we are in many ways about incorporating the inclusion agenda and starting from the starting point of pupils, to support them to move forward appropriately, whatever, you know, whether it be a poverty environment or a more enriched environment that one might expect, because as we know, it's not always monetary that decides whether an environment is poverty ridden or not. But, you know, the assertion you made there about the children who had that member of the family who had that very vivid experience, I would be taken aback with most of my teacher colleagues not to find that one of them did use that information and incorporate it into an approach to IBL or in some aspect of the curriculum.
And this is what we need to emulate and spread this.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I just wanted to make a plea for the fact that, to my absolute personal knowledge, there are a number of what one might call deprived areas who are actively seeking to move children forward from their starting point, to take every advantage of the opportunities that are out there and to start from where they are.
And curriculum for excellence gives the opportunity for some of this.
Well, I would say in our school we make a high priority of getting to know the children, and I think we pride ourselves on knowing our children.
Indeed,
really
when we talk about early teacher education, even in teaching practice, isn't that one of the things we say to people before you even go to visit the school? This is not for your full time job, this is for your teaching practice. You know, go out there, have a look at the school, wander about the area, get to know what people are like, you know. And so I think that, and especially in terms of partnership working and the usages that we put our school buildings to now, I'd be surprised if there was still that somewhat traditional dichotomy between the community and the school environment.
I think we've got to get these stories across, and I think we've got to get some of the excellent journalists on TESS involved in spreading the news of the best practice.
And I think this,
because it is mixed, but there is the best practice there.
And this idea basically of knowing your children is at its most basic level what they mean by personalising learning.
Mm-hmm. Yes. It is difficult. It is difficult. It does take time to actually... I mean, we only found out these things about these three children by asking some very open but positive questions. And the teacher who thought he knew those children well was quite surprised at what he discovered in those 20 minutes.
I think one of the things to me as well is that, you know, we all talk about the aspirations in that, the child, and the parents in that from some of these areas. And you know, I think you can't find a parent that doesn't aspire for their child to do well at school. And if you actually talk to the kids, we're getting kids that come in from as early as 10 and take them up to 16, who are generally non-attenders, have been non-attenders in mainstream, and we're getting them in, and we're trying to get them through an education programme. Now, most of them, they aspire to achieve their, you know, their exams and to finish school in a positive way. But the thing that seems to be missing is the expectations. They don't expect to do well. Yes. They aspire to do well, but they don't actually expect to do well. And that then comes into their self-esteem. And I think in order to improve that, we really need to look at the link between the self-esteem and the expectation that the child themselves has to do well and then to go on to further education, if that's something we can
yeah.
do.
Yeah. But I think it's also something about the economy of course. Traditional norms in schooling, what you fall back on if you don't think about it, you know, and what you fall back on is the economy of having to do this. It's a bit like alienated labour if we're not careful. You have to do this, you have to do it till 10:45, you hand it in and you get a mark for it. That's a very different dynamic to the schools. I did a study 12 years ago of very successful inner city schools, and one of the characteristics of those schools was the amount of presentation to others that was going on, the amount of celebration, the amount of performance, the amount of writing, where a group of children solving a problem would do a poster and then talk to the others about it. It was quite a different sort of set of rewards and feeling of satisfaction that was developing. So I think we need to explore these issues more.
Larry. And two things. One of them, just because everyone's here at this seminar, I thought it was an interesting issue. So we just do a quick advert. You have EIS is running a major poverty and its impact on education conference. It's in April. It's on the website and free to members. We have around 20 workshops set up, so you're all invited. But the point I wanted to make was back to this issue of success and how you measure it, because CFE gives us a chance to actually measure aspiration and success in a different way. I think a lot of the sense of failure that kids have in school was around qualifications. But qualifications was the be-all and end-all. So if you didn't get your hires or you got foundation awards or standard grade, that was seen as a failure. You know, and if you look at the set and practice of schools around standard grade, kids would come up to you and tell you, "I'm in the foundry club," you know, and they had that sense of failure before, and it's because in a lot of schools, qualifications was a benchmark for success, and I think CFE actually gives you a chance to look at, well, what is success? So success might actually be they've left school and they've got onto a college course. You know, I think you have to reframe. The notion of what is a successful education process, because I think it has to be much more around the sense of self-esteem that the child leaves school with, you know, and the notion that they are confident about their forward pathway, whatever it is, rather than, and if I'm talking about, when I started teaching the A's, one of my first classes was called the Vocky class, right, and that was before we had standard grade. And these kids are leaving school at 16 with no qualifications. The system was designed that way. And they were out in the huts. And I wasn't sure if it was me that was out in the huts or they were out.
Yeah.
So it was
being there, done that, yeah.
And we didn't want a standard grade to actually try and have a more all-encompassing framework. But I think CFE gives us a chance to actually move that on again and have a bigger focus on the whole.
And as Scotland, I think we're developing in Scotland that situation where you can hit that level when you reach it, you're not closed off from it.
Yeah.
The only difficulty is exactly the one that you're putting, Larry, which is, you know, the kids who, is there a present version of the kids who are out in the hubs? I mean, my daughter's attended one of the best schools, and it's a lovely, lovely school, but they soon identified that the kids in the top sets used to call the bottom sets the colouring in groups. So there is a question, even in schools in much more mixed areas, is there actually a pedagogy of poverty, you know, which actually limits you? And somebody's a colleague who's expert in literacy at Edinburgh, a guy called George Hunt, he pointed some research where the children who are weakest at reading at the age of 8 or 10 subsequently get the least to read and the least chance to develop their reading. And I've noticed in trailing a class through the day, sometimes the teacher is so keen to help the children who will struggle with the reading that he paraphrases everything and the kids don't actually read. So we've got to find our ways of understanding all of this in respectful ways, but don't go down the English road of bash the teacher. But I think it's an agenda we have to take seriously. I'm delighted that you've got this conference room. It's brilliant.
So I remember the standard aid came in, there was a cartoon in a, I think it was called Teaching English, a teacher's magazine, and it was the foundation history class. And the wee boy at the desk, he turned to the teacher and said, "So, sir, why did Stalin or Trotsky get assassinated?" And the teacher's reply was, "Just colour him in like the rest of the class." And that was back in the 80s.
But it could happen today.
Well, listen, I had a flea steak in French where the kids were colouring in flowers and then writing the French name of the flower beside it. And that unfortunately wasn't that long ago. But I think the wheel's turning.
And Tim Brighouse, I'll come to you, but Tim Brighouse mentioned the Kez moment. And I had one of these negative Kez moments teaching the school in Rochdale where the fields were just outside. And these kids staring out the window all the time. They want them to listen to me. And I said, "Look, we're actually reading the book." And I said, "We're on page 53. Can't you concentrate for one moment?" There's a kestrel up there. I don't think I recognised the kestrel, but they knew. So,
firstly, I'd echo. I think it's really encouraging that there's the EIS are really concentrating on this now and taking forward a conference. But I think to be it's such a crucial issue and to be slightly pessimistic about it, the next few years I would foresee are going to be extremely difficult and are going to create significantly greater amounts of poverty across the country. Specifically, I think that there are the benefit cuts that are actually coming in. Are just beginning to start to bite just now. I think the effects of those over the next sort of 2 to 3 years are going to create yet another wave of poverty and probably drive the problem even deeper, which again I think from an education point of view
and the material impact. Absolutely. But also the psychological impact of the discourses that are being peddled around us.
The other side of it is obviously the increased impoverishment of greater amounts of children and families. But on the other side of that is that we're still got a few years ahead of further revenue cuts in terms of the resources that all services actually have. So it's a really important debate, and I think the challenges are going to be even greater for teaching and all other professions as well.
I just feel that really, because of working in the area of social emotional behavioural needs, it's the challenge of sometimes, when there are children who there are parents on board, maybe there's a breakup in the marriage, but there's still something professionals. Where some children, they really live with shame because one parent is in a prison, or the other parent, the remaining one, is mental illness or is depressed. And it's really a challenge to find a way to channel their attention, to give them hope that they can experience success. It's a real challenge. And unexpectedly for me, one boy, mother was very depressed. Suddenly out of the blue, he says, "All I want to be is a joiner." And it's as if, something has made sense to him. And I know it isn't something he says he wants to go to university or something like that, but yet something in front of him wants to be a joiner. But his great difficulty containing his behaviours, and he can't be sometimes in a class. So sometimes with some of these cases, it's really a challenge to work with them. It's wonderful when there are, this whole question of opposing who are
inspiring people that you know in your lives. I really would like to pose to some of them, do you know, but it is really challenging, I have to say that sometimes. I mustn't give up hope on some of these children.
Anybody else, or is it lunchtime? A fascinating discussion. I mean, if anybody wants to get involved in this national venture, just let me know. Thank you.